Oh, there's so much news. There's too much news. Let's just... I think we should just like that that football player. Retire at the half. So at 2 o'clock, we're just going to walk out. Just walk out. Or maybe like that boxer who decided, I'm leaving the ring. I'm not doing this. I don't know.
Who did that?
It happened twice. Actually, one guy got hit, knocked down, and then he said, I'm finished.
Right.
You hit me hard enough, I'm going away. Oh, hour of openness. You know, we could have just an open hour, but we tend not to do that. So it's about being open and honest and trying to be brutally honest on the radio sometimes is painfully...
Painful.
Painful. That's a good word. Yeah. Leslie Lowe's in our studio, author of No Place to Go, Coach House... What?
Coach House Books, yeah.
Coach House Books. How Public Toilets Fail Our Private Needs.
Bingo.
And I got to say, the toilet paper roll on the right is not correct. It goes under, not over.
Oh, you're one of those.
You're not, what do you mean one of those? There's only one way to do it.
I don't always
change the toilet paper roll. When I do, though, is to put it on correctly. That's my meme for the day.
I do not include that in my book.
No, I know it's not about that. Senate hearings in the United States.
Mm.
Or not Senate hearings, but congressional. It's about the
Kavanaugh.
Supreme Court nominees accused are facing questions and allegations. So much going on. Leslie, how do you keep on top of it all?
How hard was it to book me to come in?
Oh, yeah, right.
You know I don't keep on top of it all.
That's right. You say, how come I'm not on your show talking about my book? And I said, how about tomorrow? No.
Radio silence.
Can't do it. Maybe the next day. Nope. You are traveling North America from Lunenburg to Fairfax, Virginia in the next few days.
Well, yeah.
Weeks.
Oakland, California. So Lunenburg,
where
I was just in Toronto on Sunday.
Okay.
Yep.
Leslie Lowe at the Lunenburg Lit Festival.
Yeah.
Not like the kids lit. This is literature.
No, it's going to be lit though.
You didn't say AF.
Lunenburg and then Oakland, I think San Diego, Sacramento, actually. Sacramento.
Leslie Lowe at the Fall for the Book
and
Festival.
And then Fairfax at George Virginia. Mason University's Fall for the Book.
Number one in addressing the politics of where we're allowed to go in public.
Yeah.
From pay to use toilets to deserted alleyways. So is this a North American issue? Is this a Nova Scotian issue? Where did this journey to the loo begin for you?
Well, you're asking two questions there. It's Canada, the U.S., and the U.K. is what my book covers, but it's a worldwide issue. Obviously, we all have hang-ups, and we all have a lot of issues, and it touches on a lot of social justice issues. But the reason I wrote the book, which is, I think, the other question you're asking, is because I had kids... A long time ago, it feels like.
You
now.
Still have kids, don't you?
I do, okay. unless I've lost
that's
them.
That's only one question. I mean, I'm just being clear.
I did say on the weekend, I don't know where she is or what she's doing. So when I had kids, what I discovered was I couldn't navigate the city the same way I used to. So when I talk to audiences about this, when I do a reading or go do a talk, I sort of explain it this way. I start lead off by saying, I am very bathroom privileged. Public bathroom privileged. And so anybody who's listening out there can follow along and do the little checklist in their head. So I'm cisgendered. So my gender matches my gender expression. I'm never going to be questioned going into a women's bathroom because nobody's going to question my gender. Whereas if you're transgender, that may not be the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, more so for women than men. Transgender
right,
women.
Yes,
than
yes.
Men.
That's right. And trans individuals face, this is not, you know, like anecdotal, this is statistically proven, face violence and verbal abuse in bathrooms. It is not uncommon. Hmm. I am white. So we saw this summer in Philadelphia, two African Nova Scotian businessmen went into a Philadelphia Starbucks and they were arrested for trying to use the bathroom. They were waiting for a third man who they're having a business meeting. So there are divides there.
Right.
I'm healthy. So I don't have Crohn's, colitis. I don't have urgent bathroom needs. So I don't have to constantly be like on alert for where is the closest bathroom. And I need it in the next 30 seconds when I need it. Mm-hmm. I'm able-bodied. So I never have to worry about a mobility device and whether I can get into a bathroom. I'm losing my list of privilege. I'm housed, right?
Okay. So you can always go home.
What do you mean? I can always go home.
No, no, no.
Oh, to my house.
Yeah, to use your own washroom.
Yeah, that's right. If I need to.
If you need to.
But it stretches out from there, right? Because,
yep.
You know, if you are disheveled, if you may have soiled yourself because you don't have access to a bathroom, you are highly unlikely to get into a public bathroom that is inside a business, right? Mm. San Francisco has one example of a big city that has a massive open defecation problem. Keeps a poop map. They have a municipal poop map, so they know where human feces is, and they know where to truck their mobile toilets. And Toronto's got, you know, these problems are real. People are pooping outside because they don't have access to public bathrooms.
Okay, so that is where you approach, that's the direction from which you're coming to approach this story.
Yeah, so I have a lot of privilege. Where I don't have privilege is that I'm a woman. And getting back to my story about my kids, when I had kids, all of a sudden, I was a caregiver. And that pulled me down a notch in terms of privilege. Like, I had this little person with me who I cared for who would look at me and say, I need to pee.
I gotta go.
And I would be like, great. And this was at a time before I lived very close to the common. And we would frequently go out to the common, my newborn and my two-year-old. And what would happen would be, there was no North Common public bathroom at this point. And even now, that bathroom's not, they never winterized it when it was built. So it's closed October through May.
Hmm.
And so we would end up not, we would end up having an accident, basically, and having to go home. So it really changed the way I navigated the city. And it sort of opened my eyes to the fact that public bathrooms are this really kind of important touchstone in terms of how we take ownership of our cities, how able we are to access them, and how that changes depending on who we are.
Hmm. Leslie Lowe in our studio today. She is the author of a book about public washrooms that she will be speaking on and helping to illustrate her point, perhaps. In the next, well, as we say, Lunenburg is the next place you're at, and I lost the book page here. No Place to Go, How Public Toilets Fail Our Private Needs. Now, this anecdotally is a story about, so where does the book go?
Yeah, so each sort of chapter of the book takes on a different issue. So I have an issue about trans people and challenges they face. I talk about the history of public bathrooms. I talk about being a woman. So that's kind of the through line, which for me personally, you know, it's a piece of creative nonfiction. It's not a history, ultimately. It's not an academic work. So I'm storytelling in this.
Right.
And my story is that I'm a woman. And so it means I've spent my entire life, continuing today, waiting in line for public bathrooms. And I think that for me, this is a really obvious one. And I can hear the eyes rolling. But what happens with women, do you want to know why women wait in public bathroom lines?
Tell me more.
I will gladly tell you more. So, typical side-by-side public bathroom installation inside a building has equal floor space for men's and women's. Okay, so
okay.
Just let's plant that seed right now.
Yep.
If I go to the bathroom and you go to the bathroom, it takes me longer to go to the bathroom than you. So number one, it takes me longer to empty my bladder. You can sidle up to a urinal. I cannot. I'm going into a stall. I have to shut the door. I have to lock the door. The locks, every woman listening will know, frequently do not lock. It takes a little bit of fiddling. I have to remove clothing, more clothing than a man would typically. I may be menstruating. I put my clothes back on. I go out. I wash my hands. So that in itself, the numbers are, there's a couple studies that I cite in the book. One says women take about 90 seconds. Men take about 60. But, you know, it takes women longer. So there's your first thing. You can see the line growing, right? But that back to that side-by-side bathroom installation, you think of, if you're in Halifax, the Rebecca Cohn Auditorium, equal floor space for men's and women's, whereas in the women's side, they may fit 3 stalls. In the men's side, they can fit a stall and 6 urinals or more. And so in many older buildings, so pre-90s buildings, what you see is women need about 2 or 3 times the provision of men. They need about 2 to 3 times the number of bath toilets.
Mm-hmm.
What they often get is half. And that's why women wait in bathroom lines. So I see that as this really smack in the face, obvious indicator that built spaces are gendered. those spaces are built for men because they privilege men, right? Very, very clearly.
Is it intentional or is it ignorance, small I ignorance, that men don't understand that men particularly, if we're talking about the architects, the builders, the contractors.
That's right.
They're not thinking of you.
No, like, I mean, 20% of engineers are women, you know? It is simply that men's experience is not women's experience, and women are not being consulted when it comes to this stuff. There are not enough women who are working in architecture, especially, like, big, splashy architects. Very few of them are women. But, you know, like, so that builds into the problem, right? That makes it worse.
Leslie Lowe is here. We need to take a break. We're going to keep the conversation going. I want to ask a little bit about how people are receiving your book and how well it's doing. I don't know if that's a fair question to ask. But
yeah, sure.
And there was a story that came out early this spring in May, and it was a video from a security camera at a coffee shop in, I think it was in Alberta, perhaps.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, the woman who...
Angry Pooper?
That's the one.
BC.
We'll talk about the Angry Pooper, too, when we get back. Number two. Number one. We'll be right back after this. We're talking washrooms here. No Place to Go, How Public Toilets Fail Our Private Needs, published by Coach House Books. The author is Leslie Lowe, and Leslie Lowe is here with us on the radio this afternoon. You've had the opportunity to do some traveling, to talk about your book. You've spent some time at several events here in Halifax and in Nova Scotia about this. Was it Word on the Street was that last?
I was not invited to Word on the Street.
Oh, you weren't?
I was in Word on the Street in Toronto last weekend.
Oh, okay. So that's where you were, and that's why I saw it. Has this conversation come up about the woman from BC who got so frustrated with staff at a washroom at a restaurant that she
in the spring
let go on the floor and then threw it at someone?
Yeah, she did. I think as part of other interviews for book coverage, I've talked about it a little bit. Mm. And I have it in my, it's in my book. It was like one of the very late editing editions to my
Hard
book.
Hard not to put this into a book about public.
Yeah.
Because we were led to the conclusion that this was a woman who was denied access to the facility.
Yeah. And I'm not entirely certain, and it's quite unclear, but it does sort of speak to, regardless, like it doesn't really matter if this is a complete outlier, if this is somebody who is unwell, if this is a woman who has been unjustly denied access to the bathroom, if it's a person who has been denied and has Crohn's or colitis, like what it points to is this. There are public bathrooms and there are publicly available bathrooms.
Okay.
So let me parse that out a bit. So public bathrooms are paid for by the government. They are free. Hopefully they're 24/7. They're on the street and they're available to anyone, no questions asked.
Right.
And then there are publicly available bathrooms. So that would be...
We have no washroom facility for non-paying customers.
Well, or even, I mean, in the wake of this situation that happened in July in Philadelphia in the Starbucks where the two African-American businessmen were arrested, Starbucks, I mean, this is a big deal. Starbucks closed down for a day to do training about racial sensitivity training and recognizing bias. And the CEO of Starbucks declared, our bathrooms will now be available for anyone.
That's a huge issue.
It is big. However, they won't be. Because if I have, as I said in the first segment, if I've soiled myself and I am in week-old clothes that I've repeatedly soiled myself in because I am street involved and maybe I have an addiction or whatever, of course the Starbucks employees are probably going to say, I'm sorry, but you have to go.
Yeah. You have to leave.
Exactly. Yeah. So they are always going to reserve that right to deny. And that's even kind of embedded into whatever the language was that the CEO used when he said, you know, our bathrooms are going to be open. Mm-hmm. So this gets back to the angry pooper, whatever the angry pooper's motivations were, because it points to this sort of world we live in right now where we actually think Tim Hortons is a public bathroom or Starbucks is a public bathroom or a mall or a hotel. And can you imagine a world where the Lord Nelson Hotel was responsible for installing the streetlights outside of the Lord Nelson Hotel or paving the sidewalk or putting trash cans there? Like, we have all these sort of public amenities in the common that we agree as a society, okay, we're going to jointly share the cost of these things, right? Trash, lights. I'm just looking outside the window here. It's some, you know, street Well, that's a bad example. Anyway, you get my point. Mm-hmm. But we would never ask or expect a public business to cover this.
You mean a private business?
A private business to cover this, because it's just completely unacceptable. However, mm-hmm. when it comes to bathrooms, somehow we think, yep, okay, you know, this will be a stand-in. It's not an acceptable stand-in.
So this is an issue of government, of governance. We had someone who tweeted at us, you know, problem solved in Europe. But one washroom, row of stalls, floor to ceiling walls, row of sinks, everyone uses the same room.
Mm-hmm.
There's privacy, obviously, and there's a way to clean up afterwards.
Yeah. So not everybody would agree with that. So I think that's actually a good workable solution, right? And that is, you know, and that you do see that quite a bit. You see, you know, you go into a public building and if it's a single stall, quote unquote, single room bathroom, you know, a toilet and a sink.
Yep.
Okay. It's all gender. Great.
But, and I know that some of the businesses in Halifax have done so through renovations.
Yep.
That there are no specific men's or women's.
Yeah.
But one room with one appliance, so yep. to speak, slows things down.
Yeah. And there's a big kind of rift in the toilet activist world, particularly when it comes to women, because, you know, I just rolled out why women wait in bathroom lines.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of, like, the National Building Code, for example, addresses that. When you have a newer, extensively renovated building, you have to build in, it's called potty parity. So it's like 2-to-1 or 3-to-1
right.
ratio in favor of women. So it tries to address that inequity in our society. But it's women. Some women are very reluctant to give up space for all gender bathrooms because they see this historic discrimination, and they see, okay, money is being put in here. Like, level it out for 51% of the population. Mm. Let's just put this on the back burner, this all gender thing on the back burner, and let's give more money so we can make it better for women. That's not my thing. But I hear that a lot, and I see that a lot in people I'm, you know, speak to online about public bathroom access. Mm.
No Place to Go: How Public Toilets Fail Our Private Needs. Leslie Lowe is the author. She's our guest in our studio. She'll be in Lunenburg this coming weekend.
Yes? Saturday.
Saturday.
Yeah.
When I see a book like this, I wonder, okay, you can give examples of why perhaps it's failing. Are the answers? Do you provide answers in this book?
I don't provide a whole lot of answers. I mean, I advocate for a sort of expansive overhaul in terms of access for women and making more all-gender options, because those don't exist. I mean, like, I have Google alerts set up about public bathroom access, and it's literally daily. I get like 10 or 20 news stories daily, and there's so many issues. And one, you know, that comes up all the time, which you may not think about, is like men having access to baby change tables.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I can't believe we're still having that conversation, you know? And that's another example of a gendered space, right? When
yep.
when there's no baby changing table in a men's. So, like, there are a lot of little fixes that you can put into place without spending a lot of money. So that's one. Make sure there's access in both restrooms. Make sure there's enough cleaning taking place.
Mm-hmm.
That's really important, because a lot can happen in an hour. You know, when it's somebody coming in and looking at the hour in an hour and signing on the back of the paper on the back of the door, like
yeah.
a lot can go wrong in an hour. And people don't always speak up and say, oh, your restroom is, you know,
yeah.
XYZ is wrong with it.
Yep.
But I mean, beyond that, there's a lot of design issues that I suggest in the book, which could be modified. But it's hard, because so many of our neuroses are kind of held in this space. It's a space that is designed for a deeply private activity, yet it is public. It's a space where we exclude, almost by definition, you know, when we have gendered bathrooms, it's like got a big flag. This is a space where we exclude.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings in a lot of politics and a lot of issues about our humanity.
It's inevitable. We all do it, but it's not a conversation we often have.
Yeah.
We only have a few seconds left. You're pleased with the reaction you're getting to the book?
Yeah, it's been really good. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I've been in Toronto, and I was in Winnipeg and Montreal. I had three events in Minneapolis.
Hmm.
You know, I had like 50 people come out to an event in Minneapolis. So people were really, I think here's the thing. When you write a public bathroom book, you tell people, oh, yeah, my book's about public bathrooms. There's only two responses. Mm-hmm. The first one is like, people are deeply uncomfortable because we're uncomfortable about bathrooms, or people think it's gross.
Yeah.
But as soon as you start explaining it, every single person says, oh, actually, yeah, you're right.
I know
and
what
here's
exactly
my story.
You're saying exactly.
Yeah.
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 Well, Leslie Lowe, thank you for coming and tell us about this.
Sure.
Good luck with the future travels.
Thanks.
I know that you'll be opening yourself up to these conversations, and I'm sure many will want to engage with you over this.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks for having me in.
We'll take a break. We'll be back in just a few moments. We'll talk about, a survey that was done of the members of Parliament of Canada about how to better, perhaps, how to increase the efficacy of democracy in this country. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the second hour of the Sheldon McLeod Show here on News 95.7. Glad to have a few moments of your day here as the rain lets up a little bit. Things cooling off as well. You're listening to the Sheldon McLeod Show. Matt Brand is a producer of our broadcast. We usually go to you as members of our listening audience and our friends and followers on Twitter with our question of the day, things that are happening in our world or perhaps on the show and how it might coincide or perhaps collaborate with that social media platform. And perhaps that's something we can talk about in a little bit. Producer Matt, have we put some thought to a question of the day?
Yeah, absolutely. You and Leslie got, I'm not going to say you got into it, but a mild disagreement about the best way to hang your toilet paper on the roll.
Oh, it goes over. It doesn't. It goes under.
Well, we can leave that up to the...
Okay. That's a good one.
We're a democracy here, I like to think.
Sounds good for me.
Speaking of which...
Oh, yeah. Speaking of... Nice segue, sir. Very well done. We are joined by, the Samara, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, Center for Democracy. And I ran across this story just the other day. And, it said in the spring of 2018, the Samara Center for Democracy continued its annual tradition of surveying current members of Parliament. Previous surveys focusing on examining specific aspects of parliamentary life, like decorum. We know that's been a subject of some discussion this week, decorum in the House. On the line with us this afternoon is Research Director Mike Morden. Mr. Morden, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Is it Samara or Samara?
Yeah, I say Samara, so I think you got it.
All right, Samara. So this was a chance to speak with the members of this parliament, the current sitting House of Assembly in Ottawa. So what is it that you wanted to hear from them, and how did you get that information out of them?
Sure. This is a broader survey. Actually, as you mentioned, we'd surveyed in the past, and we were approached by a group of MPs who have created a new group in Parliament, the All-Party Democracy Caucus. So MPs from all parties who have an interest in improving the health of our representative democracy. So they wanted to kind of sound MPs on how they felt the House of Commons was working in general and in specific ways, and also to get their views on a series of reform proposals that have been kicking around for years in Ottawa. So we distributed surveys to MPs, as we do. We banged on doors and so on. We heard back from 100, so about a third of MPs.
Okay, is that enough to draw conclusions?
It's about as much as you can expect. You know, a third is a pretty good response rate. It's such a small number in the first place that you can't survey MPs scientifically in the way that you can 35 million Canadians.
Right.
So what we try to do is make sure it's a cross-section of the House. It's not all Liberals, for example, in hopes that that gets us closer to a fair representation.
And I guess that was the question I had, is this an anonymous survey, or do you completely, the people who participate, completely on the record with, you know, who they are and the party that they represent?
It's an anonymous survey, but we do ask them to identify their party. We also give them the option not to, and some do, but most identify the party, which gives us a sense. And the breakdown lines up fairly closely with the House itself. But no, we keep it anonymous because, you know, the hope is that we can get MPs to speak candidly and to depart from whatever party line might apply in a given instance. And so, you know, the hope is that this is one of the few opportunities MPs have to really speak honestly about what they think is working without fear of, you know, punishment from the leader.
Yeah, I was going to say, if Elizabeth May fills that out, it might be a little easier to narrow down who it was.
Yeah, we tend to have to exclude the Green Party breakdown for that reason, yeah.
Right. Again, we've got Mike Morton here, research director with Samara Center for Democracy. They surveyed MPs about what can be done to strengthen Canada's parliamentary democracy. Just reading the executive summary here, and, well, a debate debacle. Again, this comes down to this whole question period issue, does it? That it's not answer period, but why should we worry about whether or not it accomplishes anything?
Yeah, that's one thing that comes across really strongly, regardless of which MPs are responding, where they sit in the House, which is that debate is just the worst part of Parliament, in their view. It's where they feel the least empowered. So debates, generally, question period in particular, it's where they feel the least empowered to do anything really meaningful. It's where they're the least satisfied. We asked, you know, we gave them a series of values to say, to what extent are you satisfied with this aspect? Thoughtful and civil debate featuring meaningful exchanges of views by members. That was the area where MPs are the least satisfied. So, you know, we're not terribly surprised when we see some of the eruptions like we saw this week, because opposition is beyond frustrated about the kinds of answers or non-answers they're getting. The governing party is frustrated with a state of heckling and incivility. Nobody's happy.
Yeah, that's an understatement. Sorry, that's an editorial comment by me. Mike Morton joins us. And I want to jump the secret sauce, because we can come back to that. We've had an issue in Nova Scotia that might relate to that. But mixed messages. And here's where, and this has only come up since, you know, we asked to have you join us on the broadcast. You know, we had this conservative motion on Opposition Day that said, you know, we implore the House or the Department of Veterans Affairs to take away funding for Christopher Garnier, who's being treated for PTSD after being convicted of murder. And all the members of the Liberal caucus voted against this. And I know that my member of parliament, someone had snapped a picture of that vote. She didn't look very happy about it. But on the same day that the Liberal Party, the members in the House who belong to the Liberal Party were saying no to that, the minister came out and said, well, we are looking at this policy to change the policy on a go-forward basis. And that in some ways says, you know, how they vote in the House compared to what the government says does send a certain amount of a mixed message, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's one instance where that's certainly the case. You know, at the same time, yeah, that's a complicated one, because at the same time, when you see the whole party stand up like that, you know they're probably under instruction from the party center as well. So that's an instance where the government itself, it seems, hasn't quite figured out just exactly what message it wants to broadcast. And I wonder if that's a case where the opposition kind of put them in a corner a little bit by forcing the issue with that motion before the Liberals were ready to respond.
Yeah, and I get a sense that, you know, hold your nose and vote with the party line. Yeah. But that said, you know, that's the mixed message. How do you then go back to your constituents and say, well, yes, you've got a point, but I can't not vote for my leader?
Yeah, I think that's a challenge. I mean, that's something, you know, we got at a little bit in this survey, but we hear a lot. Another thing we do is interview former parliamentarians, again, because they can speak more candidly. They're no longer seeking office. They no longer have to behave, in a sense.
Right.
And look, we just hear that all the time. We have a parliament that is really unique in the world in the extent to which party discipline is observed. MPs have very little leeway. It's really quite extraordinary. And MPs will say privately to us that they don't fully understand it, for the very reason that you've suggested. It makes them in some ways less effective at trying to bridging the interests of their party with the interests of their constituents.
Yeah, we've got as our guest Mike Morton, a research director with Samaritan Center for Democracy. This is about a survey that was done of the members of the House back in spring of 2018. So, Mike, this secret sauce, the idea that what we see in question period where the cameras are rolling, that's, you know, it doesn't seem like a whole lot's accomplished other than sniping across the floor, that many of the members say, you know what, I'm on a committee, we're doing some great work, but much of this is happening and no one knows of this?
Yeah, that's exactly it. The areas of Parliament that are the least accessible in some ways to the public are the ones where MPs feel most empowered to do real work and where they feel the most satisfied. Committee is one example. Now, you can you can tune into committee if you really want to. Not many people do. MPs also talk about their caucus discussion. So, you know, they all get in a room on Wednesday mornings with members of their party, and they have a little deliberation, hash out some issues. That's another area where they feel like they actually can exert some influence. The problem is it's in private, and so the question we're left asking is there a way to bring some of that good debate and deliberation out into the open, or is it that as soon as it becomes public, you've got all these political incentives that compel people to start behaving the way they behave in question period, you know, trying to get off the one-liner, knowing that, you know, that's the little clip that's going to end up on the news.
Yeah, or dropping an F-bomb.
Well, yeah.
That one resonated too. And reforms visited or revisited. So what is this about?
So we crowdsourced a number of possible reform options that have been discussed in the past from MPs themselves, and then asked MPs what they supported and didn't support. And so what we found was, while there was real consensus about where the problems lay, mostly in debates, there was really not much of a consensus at all on where to start with reform. Just a lot of very mixed responses. You know, some of these issues, I think, become tainted with partisan politics, which is what we were sort of hoping to avoid. And in general, there's a sense that, you know, MPs actually don't get a lot of time to reflect on the institution itself. They're running back and forth from Ottawa to the constituency and responding to the issues of the day. And I think a lot of MPs don't really know what's possible and haven't really considered alternatives to the status quo. And so there's a role there to actually educate MPs themselves about what Parliament could look like.
It's a fascinating study, and it's published. If anyone's interested in reading all 22 pages of the report, they can go to Samara Center for Democracy, and the link is pretty easy to find right there at the front. It's a fabulous investigation into, perhaps the attitudes of those behind the scenes, perhaps some insight as to what's going on outside of the regular newscasts or the pieces we see in the news. But keep up the great work, Mike. Thanks for this.
Oh, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Take care, sir. Bye-bye. Mike Morton, Research Director with Samara Center for Democracy. And that said, that F-bomb this week, I found there was a member who stood up and said that the Prime Minister didn't give an F about Indigenous people in this country. And, you know, some have said, oh, unparliamentary. I think, well, the spirit of what he said, it was lost somewhat, which is that Gord Downie, remember him?
I do. Yeah.
Calling out the Prime Minister of Canada, saying, you're the guy to do this. You're the man who needs to make a difference for the First Nations of this country. I don't think that member who stood up in the House and dropped the F-bomb feels that the Prime Minister's quite lived up to Gord's urgings, so to speak.
Yeah, and he's a lot of blowback for that member, but I mean, you're not allowed to say that word. But I mean, given what he's talking about, you can understand his frustration.
That was deliberate.
Yeah,
it was on purpose. It was sending a message.
Worked.
We're
still talking about it.
Message received, loud and clear. All right, we'll take a break and eco justice. We say what? There's a lawsuit that's in the works. Okay, so there's this talk about the effluent pipe out into the Northumberland Strait, and people are saying let's sign a petition. Others are saying let's lobby our government, let's lobby our members of the Legislative Assembly. Okay, how about eco justice and the Environmental Law Charity teaming up with Friends of Northumberland Strait to file suit? We'll talk about that right after this. Here we go. It is Thursday. It's the 27th of September. Early this morning, this came into my email box. EcoJustice joins forces with Friends of Northumberland Strait to build the case against Northern Pulp's effluent pipe plan. I know the First Nations community in Boat Harbor had asked for, in Pictou Landing, had asked for, when the environment ministers were gathered here in Halifax last week, for someone to come up and visit the site and visit the area where this pipe is being proposed. And, well, the minister said that she was unable to accommodate that request, not now, maybe some other time. So maybe it takes a lawsuit to get the attention of government, or perhaps not. We'll find out what the plan is at the very least, and we're joined by one of the Friends of the Northumberland Strait. Welcome back to the broadcast, Jill Graham-Scanlon. How are you?
I'm just fine, Sheldon. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing all right. It sounds like a step towards perhaps, a lawsuit. Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, we're keeping all of our options open, Sheldon. As you know, the province has chosen to proceed with a fast-track Class 1 environmental assessment for the Northumberland's proposed pipe into the Strait. We as Friends of Northumberland Strait do not think that, number one, the pipe should go into the Strait at all, and number two, that if there is going to be an environmental assessment on this project, that it certainly shouldn't be fast-tracked Class 1. So we've joined forces with Eco Justice to attack this proposal in any way that we can.
Okay, and I guess, as you say, there are options available to you. The legal route might be the one to take. So so where next? What does this announcement today essentially mean, that you've joined forces? What does that mean?
Well, it means that we now have the expertise in environmental law coming on board with us, and that expertise in environmental law really complements the various other important skill sets that we already have within the members of the Friends Northumberland Strait. So it means that we can continue our work to prepare ourselves and prepare our response to Northern Pulp's registration document for the environmental assessment whenever they put that forward.
I believe EcoJustice was involved in a private prosecution against the Minister of Environment over contaminated water and an Environmental Cleanup Act. Is that possible, that something like that could be on the horizon for Friends of Northumberland Strait?
It's certainly possible. We haven't spoken in those specific terms, but as I said, all of our options will be left open, and we'll see where this file takes us.
You know, there are public education campaigns that can be launched. You can help get the support of your community to make perhaps a concentrated effort to put pressure on government. That is, I would assume, part of the reason why that protest rally was held in the water this past summer. But if that doesn't get you where you need to go, I guess a legal option is maybe the only one you have?
I think a legal option is one of many that we have. Certainly, it's another tool in the toolbox. The rally that we had this summer at Pictou Waterfront certainly showed us, and I'm very sure that it showed the province and other government officials and Northern Pulp that the public stands firmly behind us in our position that there be no pipe in the Strait.
Again, our guest on the broadcast is Jill Graham Scanlon. It sounds in some ways, though, you know, this release today was to kind of put not the media, not the public, but Northern Pulp on notice that this is something you guys are doing.
I think everyone should take notice of this announcement. It's a wonderful thing that EcoJustice has joined forces with us, and they see that this is an important issue for not just our area, but all of Nova Scotia and Atlantic Canada, and it shows that they're willing to work with us for free without payment because of the importance of this project.
Jill Graham Scanlon, our guest. She's one of the Friends of Northumberland Strait. We've heard from fishing organizations, other groups, others who are saying this is a concern to their livelihood. People are saying they don't want to see this effluent pipe built at all, and others suggesting they may take they may take physical action to intervene, that there may be people willing to become arrested or to get arrested in order to make their point. Jill, your background's in law, is it not?
Yes, it is. I'm a lawyer myself.
As a lawyer, what do you think, or how do you feel about people who say they'd be willing to face charges to stop this from going ahead?
Well, that indicates to me just how passionate a lot of people around here are about this this proposed pipeline going into the Strait. And I think, again, the government and Northern Pulp has to take notice of that. I hear that a lot myself. People do come up to me and they tell me that they are prepared to get arrested, as you said, and to do what it takes to stop this pipe from going in. And I think we and the rest of the public needs to be heard on this. And, you know, it's on that note, it's very interesting to know that we've made a request of both the former Minister of the Environment for the province of Nova Scotia, Ian Rankin, and the current Minister of Environment, Margaret Miller. We've reached out to both of them and asked them for an opportunity to meet and to discuss our concerns, and they haven't responded to us at all. They have not spoken to us yet.
So if they won't meet with you and speak with you to hear your concerns, how do you get your word to them other than through the media?
Well, that's a good question, and EcoJustice will help us do just that if we find that the only way to get attention is to proceed with the legal route. We'll do that.
You know, clearly they have to know. Clearly the Department of Environment has to know how your association feels about this group that you're involved with. And it's up to the Premier, I would assume, to make that, to tell us what the next step is or whether he supports what it is that you're doing.
Right. It is up to the Premier and the Minister of Justice. The file is hers. And the least she could do is lend us an ear, meet with us, and hear our concerns. And we really question why it is that they're not even willing to listen to our concerns.
Mm. Well, we'll wait to hear what happens next. Obviously, this is just fresh news, and there's lots going on these days, and the House is back in session. But for now, we'll leave it at that. Jill Graham-Scanlon, thanks for doing this. And Friends of the Northumberland Strait are clearly getting a number of people standing up and supporting the work that you're doing. So congratulations on that.
Well, thank you so much, Sheldon. Thank you for having me on again.
You take care. Jill Graham-Scanlon joining us, making the announcement today that EcoJustice, Canada's largest environmental law charity, teaming up with Friends of the Northumberland Strait to build the case against Northern Pulp's plan to pulp millions of litres of treated pulp effluent into the prime fishing grounds of the Northumberland Strait. As she says, you know, they asked Ian Rankin, they asked the current Minister of Environment, Margaret Miller, to meet with her group, with the people involved, the people who are friends of, who are asking for some, perhaps just some time to going to lay out their case. I'm pretty sure they know how these people feel and that they don't at all want this to proceed, but it doesn't sound like government wants to stop that. But I don't know, maybe it's a question that can come up with Public Accounts Committee. Oh, nope, that probably can't happen. Yeah, I know. We're going to take a break, and there was an interesting post that I read earlier today about what happened yesterday, and I thought it was interesting. Minister of Labor and Advanced Education was asked about a member's bill aimed at capping salary of executives, and then how that was reacted to, and then what else came up in the House yesterday. I'll open up that to our discussion in a bit. As a matter of fact, it's an hour of openness. That's coming your way, and we'll dig into those issues and a couple of other things I've got to set aside here. That's coming up in just a few moments, 902-405-6000. We'll be back after this news update.